This show is pre-recorded and furnished by Rowan, Gervy, and Wynn.
It's time for Gervy's Law, the intersection of law and life, with your host, injury compensation attorney, author, and mentor, Alan Gervy. Alan is managing attorney at the law firm of Rowan, Gervy, and Wynn, a workers' compensation law firm who have represented injured workers for over 35 years. Joined today by his co-host, radio personality, and television host, Kerry Kasin. Kerry brings a fresh, real perspective to the intersection of law and life, turning Murphy's Law upside down. And now, here are Alan Gervy and Kerry Kasin.
Good afternoon, Los Angeles, and everyone listening all over the world on KABC.com. I am Alan Gervy, the managing partner of the law firm of Rowan, Gervy, and Wynn. And today, as usual, I am here to be the managing partner of your life. And I am here, well, not actually here, but I am somewhere far away from Kerry Kasin. She is in studio, Kerry.
I am in studio, and you're on my, I can see you right now. I can lose my voice on FaceTime. So yeah, yes. You're far away. I'm here. We are really social distanced.
Your voice sounds very sexy, by
oh,
the way.
There you go.
And your hair looks great.
Thank you.
On FaceTime.
Keep talking.
I am in Canada. I'm quarantining in Canada. So I didn't want to miss the show. And I must say, we never say this, Kerry, but we are taping today. It is a Jewish holiday, Sunday evening, Kol Nidre, and we are taping. And we have to make that disclaimer because later on in the show, we're going to have Jackie Raffi on, and she's a cantorial soloist and the director of music of the Shomrei Torah Synagogue, talking a little bit about Yom Kippur and Kol Nidre and some reflections. So we can look forward to that from Jackie. She has an amazing voice, Kerry, so you might want to sing a duet with her.
Do it.
And before we get to Jackie, we will have Barbara Eden on. And I Dream of Jeannie is celebrating 55 years. Wow, that's amazing. I love that show. What about you, Kerry?
I grew up with that show. I mean, really, and I think still there are young kids growing up with that show. It's gone every generation. It's spanned, 55 years, and people still know who she is.
Yeah, so we're excited to talk to Barbara Eden. But there was news last Friday, actually, that was very sad for everyone. And I know for you, Kerry, because you had some posts on your widespread social media talking about Ruth Bader Ginsburg's death. And I know it touched you.
It did. You know, when we interviewed the people who made the documentary on RBG, I couldn't believe what an incredible woman she was and what incredible things she did, especially for women's rights and father's rights, you know? And so I said, it doesn't matter if you liked her politics or not. You can look at her as a woman and what she did for humanity and find something that you can say, thank you, you know, Miss Ginsburg.
And we spoke to Jeff Rosen, of course, who wrote the book Conversations with RBG. Great book. And he talked just about that. Jeff Rosen did, and Betsy West and Julie Cohn, who were the filmmakers for RBG. We spoke to them about RBG. So this whole year, we've talked about RBG. One thing we haven't done, though, yet, Kerry, is had one of the clerks, one of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg's clerks on with us. And we're really honored today to have Joe Palmore on. He is the co-chair of Morrison & Foerster's appellate and Supreme Court practice, and he's the managing partner of their Washington, D.C. office. He's argued 12 cases before the U.S. Supreme Court, and he's authored over 150 briefs in the Supreme Court. Wow. But I guess right now, Joe, we need to talk about RBG and your relationship with her as a clerk. Welcome to Gervy's Law.
Thank you for having me.
It's really great to have you, and I know this must be a tough week, and our condolences. I know you had a personal relationship with her over and above the professional relationship, and I know you tweeted, it was a tweet that got just so much attention about what kind of caring person RBG was, and you talked about really an incredible story about the daycare and your one-year-old son. Can you recap that for those who missed your tweet?
Yes, I'd be happy to. When I clerked for Justice Ginsburg in 2001, 2002, I had a one-year-old son, and we were having trouble finding a daycare spot for him. And I didn't know that the justice even knew about that. I'd been talking to my co-clerks about it, but she did, as it turned out. And I had accompanied her to a speech she was giving at the Georgetown Law School here in Washington. And we were on the way out, and you have to picture the scene. We're in a crowded elevator with security officers and handlers from Georgetown. Everyone thinks we're going down to the parking garage to leave. And she says, where is the daycare center? And one of the Georgetown personnel said, it's in the basement. And she said, I'd like to go there. And they said, okay. And Justice Ginsburg asked for something. You say yes. So the whole group, we get off the elevator. We march down to the daycare center. We walk in. Justice Ginsburg leading the way, and she addresses the woman who's sitting at the front desk and says, hello, I'm Justice Ginsburg. My clerk Joe is looking for a daycare spot for his son, and we would like a tour. Justice Ginsburg and I toured the daycare center. But what I love about the story and what I think resonated with people was it just showed what a caring person she was, and that it wasn't just that she litigated on behalf of both mothers and fathers as parents, as you mentioned, but she really lived that with her clerks and with the other personnel and employees at the Supreme Court.
We've heard so many beautiful stories like that, like what she does. You know, she was not just, like you said, a justice and not a lawyer. She went beyond that. She became your friend and she looked out for you. And were you there to witness her friendship with Justice Scalia?
Yes, I was. They were, of course, came at a lot of legal questions from a very different perspective. They disagreed fundamentally on a lot of really important issues, but they never let that get in the way of their friendship. Their families spent every New Year's Eve together. Their spouses were good friends. They traveled to India together, and there's a famous photo which you can find on the internet.
Was that with the elephants?
Yes, riding on an elephant.
Yes.
My favorite photo that was in her office.
Yes.
And they were very friendly with each other.
It's so beautiful. And what I tweeted was, you know, wouldn't it be, you know, nice? What a beautiful thing that you could be from opposite sides of the political spectrum and still respect each other and remain friends. And I just think that there's a lesson to learn from that, especially now.
You know, I had a question, Joe, because as a very busy attorney, as you are, and that's evidenced by over 150 briefs in the Supreme Court, and I'm sure that's just scratching the surface with other appellate work that you do, how did she find the time to take such a personal interest in people like you and your family and what you were doing, as well as other clerks and other people? How do you do that when you're so inundated with such complex work?
One of the answers is she didn't sleep very much.
Wow.
She was a well-known night owl and seemed to get by somehow on just a few hours of sleep a night or in the early morning. And that goes back to when she was a litigator all the way through. But she was also incredibly intentional about how she spent her time. There was not a minute wasted in her day or in her night, as it turns out. And I'm kind of reminded of, you know, you all have probably seen the Broadway show Hamilton and
yes,
song Nonstop.
Yes.
You know, you write, why do you write like you're running out of time? I mean, that's how she lived. Like, you know, she knew her, not just in the latter years when she was sick, but she knew she had limited time and she had a lot to get done. And she used every minute to do it.
What did you learn from her after your year in 2001, 2002 as a clerk? I mean, what a great gig for a young lawyer. Moving into your practice after that, what did you take from that experience?
I took a couple things from it. As you said, clerking at the Supreme Court is just the opportunity of a lifetime for a young lawyer. I learned so much just about writing, really, how to be a really clear, good writer. She was known for that. And there was a really laborious drafting process for her opinions where, you know, I would write a draft and it would come back hand marked up, you know, more that you could barely even see what I had typed up. And I would, you know, make the revisions that she had called for, and that would go back and forth. And I'd like to think that that process taught me to be a better writer and a clearer writer and to use words very economically. And I think another thing that I think I took from that year is what we talked about before, you know, based on her relationship, not only with Justice Scalia, but with everyone on the court. It's such a mutually, people there are very respectful of each other. They disagree mightily. Of course, I clerked the year after Bush versus Gore, which was an incredibly contentious case.
Right.
Yet the justices went along with their business. They knew they were going to be working together for decades more, and they continue to get along and respect each other as professionals. And I like to think that I hope that I've taken a bit of that ethic with me as well.
It's funny when you talk about writing, I think that's every lawyer's dream to be critiqued by someone like her. And I know that Jeff Rosen, when he was on our show, he talked about his wedding vows with his wife that he had given to RBG. And she did the same thing to his wedding vows. She took the red pen and sent them back to him with changes that she thought were appropriate. And he could only laugh and say, wow, brilliance. It's not only legal writing, but writing in general. And that really says something about someone. Tell us about, you know, this past week and how you were involved. I saw this really incredible picture, I'm sure a lot of people did, regarding the clerks who were standing with the casket. Have you been involved, or has it been too difficult to get away from your practice?
No, I was there this morning. I was part of that group, so that we had about 120 of her former law clerks present at the court this morning. And we lined up on the steps in the way that you saw in that image to be there to essentially receive the casket, which was driven up in a hearse and then carried up the steps between those lines by Supreme Court police officers for her to lie in repose. And then she's lying in repose on the outside during the day on the front steps.
Wow.
And then in the Great Hall at night, they've had to modify some of this because of the pandemic, of course.
Yeah, of
that's
course.
Why there's an outdoor component. And the law clerks will be standing vigil 24 hours a day.
Yeah, no, we understand it's so prevalent in the news. We only have a minute, Joe. How can you summarize, you know, your experiences and what you will think of RBG moving forward, as only you can, because, you know, obviously people didn't have the experiences that you did?
I guess I'll think about her. A lot of what I think about her is what other people are thinking about, is just her incredible contributions to this country, to the cause of gender equity. And as she famously said, it's not women's liberation, it's women's and men's liberation, because
right.
she fought mightily to lift the stereotypes that bound both men and women. And then I will always remember her as just a tremendous mentor and someone who was always in my corner.
Wow.
That's beautiful.
What great memories. And Joe, we really want to thank you for coming on the show today. We appreciate your insight and your sentiments, because I think it's something that people can really identify with, even though they weren't there to experience it. But you make it real when you tweet at Palmore_Joe, or when you speak as you have today. So thanks for being with us on Gervie's Law today.
Thank you for having me.
All right, we're going to have to take a quick break. We're going to have Barbara Eden on the show. I Dream of Jeannie. You don't want to miss that. You're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Notorious, she is. She is now. It was all a dream. Yeah, you know me. Notorious RB to the G. Started at Harvard, taking names, kicking ass. 500 dudes and 9 ladies in my class.
What?
Once I graduated, they all hated on the beta.
Welcome back to Gervie's Law, turning Murphy's Law upside down on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
We are back here at Gervie's Law. Carrie Kasem is in studio in L.A. I am in Toronto, a long way away. We are social distancing to the max today. And Carrie, I'm really excited about our next guest. I mean, it was really great hearing from Joe Palmore, the clerk for Ruth Bader Ginsburg. We're switching gears a little bit, and I think something that is really important to you and something that both of us experienced growing up.
Absolutely. I'm very excited because this is, I mean, honestly, somebody that I couldn't wait to see every week. And
yeah.
And I love the fact that, like you said, it's generation to generation. Little kids know who she is. And to have a career like that is absolutely amazing.
Yes. And we are talking about Barbara Eden. I Dream of Jeannie is celebrating 55 years. It was on the air from 1965 to 1970. 5 seasons, 139 episodes, and there were 30 black and white, which were later colorized. Barbara Eden wrote in her memoir, Jeannie Out of the Bottle, a memoir in 2012, a great read. Everyone should pick it up. She has been described as one of Hollywood's most beloved actresses, and she has been known as someone with innocence, strength, and a comedic talent to spare. She worked with people like Elvis Presley, Clint Eastwood, Paul Newman, Warren Beatty. She was a sidekick for Johnny Carson for a while. And, of course, she worked a long time with Larry Hagman on I Dream of Jeannie. Barbara Eden, welcome to Gervie's Law.
Well, thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Oh, this is so nice.
It's great to have you. And congratulations on such a great run. You know, when you go to your website, BarbaraEden.com, there's so much information, not only about I Dream of Jeannie, but about your whole career. And when you look back, I know in the book you talked about having a magical childhood in San Francisco and you had such a special relationship with your mother. How do you look back now and think about all the success you've had, specifically with I Dream of Jeannie and all the other projects, after having such, in your words, magical childhood?
Well, you mean how did the childhood, of course, I was very lucky to have. I think I was also very lucky to have worked as much as I did. I enjoyed it. So many people work at a job that they don't like, and they have to do it to feed their family. I always had a job I loved, and it was something I appreciated, and I still appreciate.
You know, I heard stories about the fact they wanted to cast somebody who was Middle Eastern or had brunette hair and was an Amazon, and here you are, you know, a petite blonde. How did that happen?
Well, I don't really know. I've been reading in the trades about this wonderful idea, and I thought, geez, that's a great idea. But they were testing all the beauty contest winners from the Middle East, even Italy, Greece. It was marvelous. But I didn't think I had a shot. And then one day my agent sent me a script and called me after I'd read it. And he said, what did you think? And I said, I love it. I just love it. He said, well, good, because they've made an offer. And I said, do they know what I look like? I mean, you know, I'm short, blonde, not Middle Eastern at all. Of course, at the time, I was married to a Lebanese.
And I'm Lebanese. My father, you know, he's 100% Lebanese. So, yeah.
I knew your father.
Oh.
Yeah, I did. I loved him.
Oh, thank you.
He went
you.
To the same church that Michael Ansara's mother went to.
The Hollywood Presbyterian?
I guess.
Yeah, we grew up in that church. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, I've rehearsed there so many times.
Did you actually meet Sidney Sheldon after that, who'd created it? And did he have any comments about how they kind of changed the script to fit who you are?
Well, they didn't. They didn't change the script at all. They left it the way it was. I had tea with him at the Beverly Hills Hotel, and we didn't discuss why he cast me. I didn't even want to ask.
Do you think you were just a better actress and had better comedic timing? Was that part of it? I mean,
well, I don't really know. Later,
you're being so humble.
Yeah, I mean, you're dealing with models. I don't know. Maybe some of them acted, but you know that. I mean, this was a comedy.
They were gorgeous, though.
I'm sure, but you. I mean, I'm sure, but the gorgeous only goes so far, and then you can't act, or you can't. You know,
that
timing isn't there. You know, that was what was so beautiful between you and Larry. It was so effortless.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I loved working with Larry. He was just, we were on the same level, you know, acting-wise, so it was great.
There were so many themes throughout the show, and, you know, I have to admit, I watched it religiously. I just thought there was so much, even as a young child, there was so much to see. But I'm sure over the years, there have been some criticisms that you've answered to when you talk about how your love for each other and how you were trying to please him. And it was written into the script, but, you know, in the last few years with the Me Too movement and some other issues that have come up, did that ever bother you, or was it something that you just saw as part of the comedy?
No, I think I always thought it was kind of silly, because here you're not talking about a human.
Yeah.
You're talking about an entity, and her job was to please her master. And she was trying to do that. Of course, she fell in love with him, but that's a whole different story.
Yeah.
And the comedy line there is the fact that she thought she was human. He knew she wasn't.
So
there you have it, right there. How can you compare that to a human woman? That you can't.
No, but nowadays, unfortunately, you would have to actually explain that, and you would have to actually say, look, this isn't, you know, and go into the feminism and this and that. It's ridiculous. I mean, look, it's comedy. It's light.
Sure,
it's something to enjoy and laugh at. But unfortunately, we've become, you know, a little bit, I guess, you know, it's gone too far. It's gone too far.
Well, you know, the other thing, Carrie, as you're talking, I'm thinking, and Barbara, you can chime in here. To me, it presented the strength of a woman, because even though, you know, you were so devoted and you talked about it not being a human, but there was really some strength of character, and you were someone who you could learn a lot from.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope so. I felt that way. I know that I've had fans recently who have told me that growing up, it was their shelter, their safe place.
Yeah.
They didn't have good families. They didn't have a place to go. So they would they'd go into their bottle. They'd make
wow.
their bedroom into a bottle, and they'd and it was very touching. And I feel really happy that I was part of that.
You know, it's interesting when you say that, because when I think about it, you know, I think that would be very motivating and helpful to people. Yet in the show, when you went into a confined space, you would lose your powers. So how did people reconcile that when they thought, you know, they got strength from you, yet when they went into a confined, when you went into the confined space, you were just like everyone else?
Well, I think probably they didn't think about that. they were thinking about safety.
Right.
Oh, okay.
And comfort, you know.
Yeah.
And they still do.
You know, my question to you is, do you think, and I might be stretching this, but I think feminism has gone so far, and this is interesting because I'm bringing this up. A guy that I started to date said to me, "It's like you're very alpha. You're like a I don't want to date a man. I want to date a woman." And I think I take care of myself. I'm I'm the one who makes a living, and you have this kind of male energy. And I think there is a point where you want, I mean, and now I'm, 48 years old, almost 50 here, and I'm just learning this. And I'm like, I want to be a woman, and I want to please my man. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. And for somebody, and feminist, don't open that door for me. It's like taking away something from the man too. And I feel like the feminism movement was good with certain things and then kind of hurt male-female relationship, that's how I feel. I feel like
love is love. And if you have a love for someone,
yeah,
that's a wonderful thing. And each of you do for the other.
Right.
It's yin and yang. It's not, you're not doing it expecting them to do nothing, or to do something.
Right, right.
Just do it because you love someone. It's like your child. You love your child. You have a different, it's very important, I think.
Oh, I agree.
You know, those are words of wisdom, and I think everyone can learn from that. We need to take a quick break. We want to talk a little bit more after the break. We want to talk about, what you've done since with some of the reunions with I Dream of Jeannie and how they're celebrating the 55th year, as well as how things have been for you in, I guess we would say, retirement, kind of, even though you had been doing a lot of shows before the pandemic, and I'm sure you will after the pandemic, but everyone is taking a little break now, and we need to take a break right here at Gervie's Law. So we'll be right back after this. You're listening to Gervie's Law on Talk Radio 790 KBC.
The glass is always half full when you're listening to Gervie's Law on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
I want to tell you all a story about a Harper Valley widowed wife who had a teenage daughter.
Yeah, we are back with a little Harper Valley PTA, and my daughter's name is Harper, so that song means a lot to me. We are speaking to Barbara Eden, one of Hollywood's most beloved actresses and someone who, just a legend. It's such an honor to speak to Barbara Eden, and to hear her philosophies really is meaningful. So much that you learn from something like I Dream of Jeannie, which is celebrating its 55th year. Barbara, when we talk about I Dream of Jeannie, tell us about, what they're doing for the 55 years. Now, I know you had several reunions through the years with I Still Dream of Jeannie and I Dream of Jeannie 15 years later, and the Donnie and Marie show, Larry King Live, Chiller Expo show. All of those things have occurred over the last 55 years. Tell us about that and what we can expect this year.
Well, after I Dream of Jeannie, of course, I did four or five films, and then Harper Valley PTA, and then I went back and did a lot of television movies. So I don't have the list in front of me, but I wasn't thinking about Jeannie at the time. You know, I was working. I appreciated her, but I didn't think about her. It was, you know, I'd done it. And then I started to sing. So in between, actually, I started while I was doing Jeannie. I went back to, I studied voice in San Francisco at the conservatory, and it came in handy because when Jeannie was down and not shooting, I would go up to Vegas and headline with Shecky Green. And I was working very hard, actually. Remember that time there was the Dean Martin show and the and Merv Griffin and
right.
Yeah, and all the Bob Hope specials. I went around the world with Bob Hope, actually, entertaining the Army and the guys in the Navy.
Do you sing still? Are you? Because I saw pictures of you at Vitello's with the Edwards twins, who I adore.
Oh, you did?
Oh, yes.
Oh, they are so wonderful.
I love them. And it's funny because I've seen them a few times, and then they went over to Singapore, and I'm like, to my brother, I'm like, he lives in Singapore, you have to see them. And they sent me a picture together, and it was very cute. Yeah,
oh, they're
fantastic.
So good.
They are
they're
so
wonderful.
Good. Yeah.
And they wanted me to work with them.
Oh.
In fact, I have all of the CDs and things here. I was going to study and go out with them.
Oh, wow.
You know, but then the pandemic.
Yeah. Oh, I hope you get to. I still hope you get to. That would be phenomenal.
Wouldn't it be fun?
Yes.
They're wonderful.
So good.
Well, you'll do it.
Yeah. Yeah.
We'll get through this.
Yes. Yes,
oh,
we
sure.
will.
Oh, sure.
Oh, wow. So are you, so you're still singing then? Would you would do a singing, I mean, because that's what they do, but are you doing anything else with your voice?
No, I'm not. It's a lot, you know, singing is like any other musical thing, like an instrument. You have to keep it up.
That's true.
And I haven't really kept it up over the years, but I kept it up enough to work with them, you know.
And you have been using your voice to do, like, love letters with Barry Bostwick and some of the other stage stuff that you've done.
Oh, yes, yes. I was looking at my calendar, and that was the last show I did was with Barry in Scranton, Pennsylvania, in the end of January, first of February.
Yeah. And you had plans to continue doing that before the pandemic hit.
Yes, we did. And then I did Out of the Bottle in Palm Springs. That's an interview show with a lot of clips from, you know, what I've done. And then I was honored at the San Francisco Conservatory of Music in February 12th, 13th, and 14th. They did a fundraiser, wonderfully, done beautifully. And that was wonderful. I cried, you know.
And you talked about in your book of dreaming of being a singer when you were young. So a lot of this music came naturally. And look at it years later, to be honored in these ways really must be meaningful.
It is meaningful. It really is. That's really how I started. It's so funny. I started by singing in church. And then when I was 14 or 15, I started studying voice at the conservatory. And my mother said, you know, Barbara, you're singing every note perfectly, but you don't mean a word you're singing. I think you should study acting.
That's what my musical theater coach said. Same thing.
Really?
You're singing, but, you know, you're not, we don't feel it. You could be the best singer in the world, but if you're not understanding and feeling what you're saying, that the audience isn't either.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. And you don't. And it's funny because when you really watch the best people on stage, they're the ones that make you feel, not necessarily the ones that have the best voice.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's
and,
right.
That was a hard lesson to learn because I'm like, my voice has got to be perfect. All right. That was a little pitchier. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So and you've worked with so many greats when you talk about singing with Elvis Presley and then acting Clint Eastwood and Paul Newman, Warren Beatty. What do you think when you think back of all of these people, who stands out in your mind and what experiences really have been highlights?
Well, you know, Elvis, I loved working with Elvis.
Wow.
He was a gentleman, a very decent man. I knew him through the years after that. It was a film at Fox. I was under contract to Fox until it closed, and that was one of the last films I did was with Elvis. But he was a lovely, lovely man and a good, good actor, hard worker. And also, he'd get me a chair when I'd come on the set.
Oh.
And there aren't
and
many actors.
Yeah.
Yes, indeed. Actors don't do that, you know.
Wow.
They're studying what they're doing. He was wonderful. I just loved him.
Wow. And are you doing any Zoom? I have a lot of friends who do autograph shows and who have been on in, you know, big movies or TV shows throughout the years, and they're not able to do the autograph shows, but they do these Zoom kind of meetings. Have you done any of those?
No,
okay.
No, I haven't. You know, I don't know about that. I don't have the lighting in my house.
You got to get Carrie to help you. Yeah. Carrie's an expert at lighting.
Yeah. You have to have the lights.
You do.
Yeah, that's right.
You do. You have to have the lighting kit. You really
everything,
do.
Everything in my house is overhead.
Yeah, which is awful. I mean, just awful. Yeah.
Or cross lighting.
Yeah.
You know? So,
yeah.
I think you look beautiful regardless of the lighting, so I wouldn't worry about it.
Well, you're very kind.
No.
Everybody needs lights.
Yes, yes, we do. Yes, we
okay,
do. I'd rather
I'll
have lighting
that.
Than makeup. But that's very, yeah.
Barbara, you just have a couple minutes. Just want to talk quickly. Your book, Genie Out of Out of the Bottle, a memoir, has done very well. Great comments about it. Tell us, how meaningful that is, because it came out in 2012, but so many people are getting it. You can get it on any, Amazon or wherever you get your books, and barbareeden.com.
Well, what was the catalyst?
How meaningful it was to write a memoir and... It's posterity. What you've put in there is something that can be read for generations to come.
Well, it was one of the most difficult things I've ever had to do.
Really?
Yeah, it really was. It's not in most people's nature to reveal their whole lives.
Right.
Yeah. The ups and downs, and you've had, a number of challenges. If someone reads the book, they can see, and we're not going to get into them now.
Like, but, everyone does, you know.
Sure.
Yeah, everyone does.
You don't necessarily want to talk about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. Very true. I have been there. And I want to write a book too, but I'm waiting for the right time. And was that your first book in 2012?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Yeah. So you waited a little while. That's yeah.
Yeah. I didn't want to do it.
Yeah.
But it came out beautifully, and I know it's challenging. It's like therapy when you talk about some of the things that you talk about in the book. Obviously, the death of your son is such a traumatic thing to talk about. So I can imagine it was a really hard, hard experience, but you pulled it off. So congratulations on that.
Thank you.
Yes.
And we want to thank you, Barbara. Barbara Eden, it's been such a pleasure having you on Gervie's Law. And it's 55 years since I Dream of Jeannie. The book is Jeannie Out of the Bottle, a memoir. And we can hopefully see Barbara on some more, once you get out there, still performing, once we're able to get into the public again.
Yeah.
Yes, yes.
It was wonderful talking with you.
Well, thank you.
Yes.
So nice to talk to you.
Aw.
Really.
Really cool that you met my dad and that you knew him. Very cool. Very cool.
Yeah. Well, everybody
knows. All
right,
we need to take a break. Thanks, Barbara. We're going to be right back. You're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Spinning wheel, got to go around. Talking about your troubles, it's a crying sin. Ride a painted pony, let the spinning wheel spin.
You're listening to Gervie's Law, the intersection of law and life on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
All right. Well, we are back, and if you hear that music, you know that we are going to now introduce our cantorial soloist and the director of music who we love having on Gervie's Law. She was on at this time last year. And I have to say, Jackie, that we have made it clear that we are taping this show. This is not live. This is not taking place on Kol Nidre because she could not be with us if we did that. Jackie Raffi is the director of music and cantorial soloist at Shomrei Torah Synagogue in West Hills. She has her law degree, and she is a lawyer from UCLA. UCLA School of Law. So there is the connection. That's why she is our resident specialist in the cantorial area. But she's a lawyer as well. She practiced entertainment law for 3 years, and she has done such wonderful work. In fact, recently, I saw that song, Justice, 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 We Will Pursue, with cantor Rebecca Mirsky and Josh Goldberg, that you did, Jackie. And that is a great tie-in with your legal career and your music career. Welcome back to Gervie's Law.
Thank you so much, Alan. It is such a pleasure to talk to you and to hear your voice, and had such a wonderful time last year. I can't believe it's already been a year. It's crazy.
I know, and what a year it's been, huh?
Yes.
Crazy.
Yes.
I mean, I do have to say, you have kept up, and you know, people have talked about you invigorating the community through your music and your spiritual leadership, and you've done it through Zoom, and this is something, and you didn't get a chance to talk to Carrie last year because she had missed the show, but I marvel at how people can make things so beautiful through Zoom, because the timing is off. How do you do it? How have you been able to get this, you know, the just really wonderful stuff done with other cantors and with other singers?
It is an excellent question. Zoom and all this, you know, all these streaming technologies, it's a huge and steep learning curve. I've had to watch hours of YouTube videos and read so many manuals and like pull my hair out. But finally I have this like little Minio studio set up in my home, and I figured out some of the sound stuff and how to, you know, make your audio settings on Zoom work so that they don't cancel out the sound if you get too loud. And it really is a learning curve, but once you get it, I think that it's really been an amazing way to engage communities through Zoom. I mean, we've had like an unprecedented number of attendees at our classes and programs and services, and suddenly spirituality is accessible globally and nationally to everybody. So it's been a really interesting experience.
I've seen people do these amazing things, whether it's on TikTok or YouTube, but I'm wondering how they put the bands together and how they get, you know, like this person's recording over there and this person's, yeah, and then they put it all together, and she's like, it's crazy to watch.
It's crazy, yeah. So, and nice to meet you, Carrie.
Nice to meet you, yes.
So, basically what happens is everybody records it on their own at home, one at a time. You usually put a backing track into your ear, and then you record yourself singing. So when it's recording, nobody can hear what you're hearing in your ear. They only hear your voice.
Right.
And then a video editor takes those videos and puts them together, and a mixer, an audio editor, puts the voices together. So it's all spliced together, yeah.
I mean, is this like when you're doing movies, you have to like clap and make sure the sound is there so it's exactly right? And I mean,
exactly.
Oh,
exactly.
Wow.
Lots
that's
of lining
lot
up stuff. Yes.
Yeah. That's a lot.
All right. So let's get to the easy stuff now, Jackie. It's Kol Nidre tonight, even though we're taping this. Tell us about the holiday, Yom Kippur, and the meaning of it, because I know you were so inspiring last year when we talked about this, and I'm sure you have a new message for us today.
Oh, thank you, Alan. So nice. You know, Yom Kippur this year, I think, has really special and important significance. There is a particular prayer. It's called the Unatana Tokef. It's a very solemn prayer, and it asks the question, who will live and who will die? And literally in the prayer, this ancient, timeless, 1,000-year-old prayer, it says, who will die by fire? Who will die by water? Who will die by illness? Who will die by plague? And so in a year that we've experienced so much uncertainty, a literal plague, fires, climate change that's causing hurricanes around the world, and lots of, you know, political unrest and all those things, this prayer and Yom Kippur in general really asks an individual to look back and reflect on the past year and think about their actions and think about the choices that you're going to make in the upcoming year. When there's so much uncertainty around, what are you going to do in your life to ensure that your life is the most meaningful that it can be, knowing that we really don't have control over the bigger things?
Yeah, and tomorrow you're having a special service at 2:00 LA time called Wake Up Your Soul. Tell us about that.
Yes, this is specifically for the 20s and 30s age range. We're looking to engage the millennial group in a creative and relevant form of spirituality and Judaism. So it's a one-hour program with my colleague, Rabbi Golko, who's at Temple Aliyah, which is down the street from the synagogue where I work, Shomrei Torah. And we've created a one-hour program of music and discussion. We're using the Zoom breakout groups, if anybody's familiar with those. So we're kind of using that Zoom technology to our advantage, and just creating a space for people to reflect and talk about issues related to self-reflection and being, again, trying to make life as meaningful as possible.
And is this done in English or Hebrew or both? Can people attend if you are like a Gentile? I mean, is that how you say it?
It is open to anybody in that age range who's interested in a Jewish spirituality or spirituality through a Jewish lens. Some of it, the talking, like the discussion part, is all in English.
Okay.
The prayers are in Hebrew, but some of them are in Hebrew and English. So it's likely relevant and to many different kinds of people.
When I went to a temple with all my friends, and I grew up in Beverly Hills, it was like everybody was Jewish, right? So
yeah.
I got to go to temple. I got to have Shabbat every Friday, and then we'd sneak out, which is terrible. But we would. So I learned my, Jewish prayers, Like, I would literally know the prayers, and we'd go to temple, or I would go to, Hebrew school. Yeah.
Awesome.
So yeah, it was super fun. And I always just thought it was so awesome. It doesn't matter what religion you are. It's such a beautiful feeling when you pray. It doesn't matter what language it's in. It's so wonderful.
So agree with you.
Yeah.
And what's interesting is that now at a time like this, it's difficult to feel connected to community when you have to be physically apart.
Yeah.
And I think Judaism, like other religions and other forms of spirituality that people connect to, it's very tied to community and tied to being with other people. So the challenge, I think, this year has been, how do you create that community, that connection, that comfort,
yes,
when you can't be together?
That's very true. That's very true. And I have attended certain things on Zoom, and it does, I think it was like 2 months into, maybe 2.5 months into the quarantine, it was like, okay, this is not okay. I need to see my friends. And we all just got on Zoom, and we were there for 3 hours. Some people were just reading, but they just wanted to hear people's voices, And it was we do need that connection, but the spiritual connection is even stronger.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
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 Agreed.
Yeah, one of the things I mentioned earlier when I talked about justice we will pursue. How did you come up with that? It's a great, and how can people hear it? Because I think it's wonderful. It's so meaningful right now with everything going on in the world, and the music is great.
Thank you, Alan. Anybody can find it on YouTube. Just search Justice, and you could, my name, Justice, Jacqueline Raffi. But I'm a co-writer. I have my colleague, Cantor Mirsky. The way that this came about is that there is a passage in the Bible, in the Torah, which is what the Jews call their Bible, and it's justice you shall pursue, tzedek tzedek tirdof in Hebrew. And this is fundamental to Jewish tradition, the pursuit of justice. And actually, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, may her memory be a blessing, Justice Ginsburg said that she had that up on her wall in her office, that saying. It is very inspiring to many leaders, Jewish leaders and non-Jewish leaders around the world, because it's a driving force for living a life in the pursuit of justice. So my colleague took this concept and what's going on in the world right now, and she wrote these lyrics to the song, and then we kind of came together to turn this into a melody, and that's how the song came about.
Wow, it's great, and it's so wonderful that you can tie your law school, your law degree, your practice of law with your music, because I know that's not something that you typically do. And while you appreciate the time you had in the law, I don't think you're looking back on it, except to do something like this when we talk about justice, and that's what we talk about in the law. So before we let you go, you have a service to do tonight. No, I'm kidding. I know.
It's horrible,
Alan. I'm horrible. I remember... We did this with Rabbi Boteach, too. It was on a Saturday, and he made it clear that we had to do the disclaimer saying that we are taping this. But tell us about what your wish is as we start Yom Kippur. And by the way, I want to wish you and your family, and you were recently married. I guess it's been a year now.
So
we wish you Shana Tova. And tell us what you're looking at in terms of meaning for this year.
Well, I want to also wish you Shana Tova and a Happy New Year. And I think that my prayer this year for you, Alan, for you, Carrie, for all of you who are listening, for everyone, is that we are able to look inside of ourselves and to find, perhaps this year is a year we look at what are the ways that our actions influence others without us even knowing, whether it's by biases or prejudices that we hold that we didn't even know that we held, whether it's by the words we speak, whatever it may be, let's think about the way that our actions make an impact, and let's look as deeply as we can into ourselves and try to make ourselves, my biggest prayer that I have is that because we can't be in our physical sanctuaries, whether you go to a temple to pray, wherever that is, a church or temple, because you can't be in a physical sanctuary, my prayer is that you make your inner world, your soul, a sanctuary, a place that's holy, a place that's whole, and a place that allows you to have loving relationships with others and with yourself.
Wonderful. It's JacquelineRaffi.com, RAFII.com, yes. Jacqueline Raffi, or at Jackie_Raffi, her Twitter feed. You can check that out. Jackie, so happy to have you on, and we wish you all the best. May this year be better than the last, and may everything and all your wisdom that you've imparted today come true, and that we all look into ourselves and have a wonderful year.
Thank you so much for having me. It's always such a pleasure to talk to you.
And thank you for your prayer. It was beautiful.
Of course. Thank you, Carrie.
Next time, you're going to sing with Carrie.
Yes, there we go.
Absolutely. I had prepared a song, so next time I'll sing it.
Oh, you should sing us out.
We need another hour.
All right, yeah.
All right. Well, thanks again, Jackie. We'll do it next time.
Okay.
And that's it for Gervie's Law this week. We'll see you next week.
We will fall down. We will be righteous, and we'll miss the mark.
This show is pre-recorded and furnished by Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn.